Today, August's Housing and Finance Update. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, where there is post covering finance and property news. Well, as you may know, roughly once a month, I record a show with Nuggets News, looking at the latest economic and housing data. And this is my edit of the show that I recorded today. And we discussed a significant number of critical issues, which will shape certainly the next 3 months and maybe the next year or two. So let's get started.
Hi guys, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Nuggets News, or our monthly housing and economy update with Martin North. How are you, Martin?
I'm extremely well, thank you. And lots to talk about, a lot going on, a lot of questions I want to pose to you today.
Yeah, there's plenty of slides to get through today as well. So I just want to start off by giving everyone a big thanks who's been watching. So we've been getting record numbers on these videos each month. And for those of you that like our crypto content, we've been starting to do more of that as well, and our premium crypto research platform is all systems go. But yeah, there's been lots happening around the world in the macro world, isn't there, Martin?
Yeah, that is. And I guess there's a couple of questions to sort of encapsulate it. Well, one is what's happening in China versus what's happening in the US, and we'll explore that. That's really switcheroo compared with the first part of the year. But the other question is, who's more important this week, Nvidia or Jay Powell? Which comes up to what's going to happen over the next few days.
Yeah, it's a digital world and AI is going to take over. So there's always going to be more need for more microprocessors. But yeah, we've got Jackson Hole coming up and all that interesting stuff, which normally makes some headlines.
Absolutely. And Nvidia's reporting later on today. So analysts are all over the place. Some saying another big number, others saying, oh, it'll be a disappointing number and the share price could fall considerably. So it really is fascinating to see how this technology wave is just driving a lot of thinking. But as I say, I actually think the critical question to explore is China versus the US and how those two economies are going and what that means for the global markets, because then of course that has a huge impact on Australia. And so what we'll do is we'll look at this macro picture first, and then towards the end of the conversation we'll look at Australia, because there's some worrying signs locally.
Fantastic. Okay, let's get into it. So I read that some of the Chinese youth unemployment data didn't come out, or they didn't release it, or what's going on there?
Yeah, so this is the last data, and it was 21% of people aged 16 to 24 who are unemployed. Now, they've said they're not going to publish this data anymore, because they're sort of questioning, well, if you're actually coming out of university and looking for a job, are you unemployed? Which is one of the reasons why the number's high. But I think there's another reason. They don't want this information going very far, because it sort of highlights some of the pressures that the Chinese economy has. And if you stand back, at the start of the year, the narrative was going to be this. China was going to pull out of COVID and they'd have a huge economic boom. That economic boom would drive momentum in the Chinese economy and therefore growth globally. Whereas in the US at that stage, everyone was talking about a recession. Interest rates will go up, but then they're going to come down later in the year. And by the end of this year, the Fed would be back down with lower rates. We'd be in a recession. And so the US economy was going to crash and burn in to some extent. Now, what's happened since then is it's all gone in reverse. So we've now got a very, very strong US economy. Unemployment is moving a little bit, but not very much. Wages are quite strong. Inflation's coming down. In China, though, we've got deflation. We've got almost no inflation at all. And we'll look at some GDP numbers shortly. And so we're in the situation where it's all about turn. And China is now in this focus, because the question is, what can they do about it? And so turning off numbers and saying, we're not going to report this number for a bit, is a worrying sign of perhaps what more of what we're going to see, because when they don't like the numbers, they turn them off.
Yeah, a bit like when we see in the Australian housing market with the data, if it gets reported fresh less regularly and things like that. It's everyone's happy to talk about it when it's going well, and then we'll sort of have it less frequently when things are turning.
That's exactly right. And so, you know, they may well start reporting this later, but they'll do it on a different basis, and therefore you want me to compare. But look, the demographic shift in China is critical to understand. There's a lot of people, younger people, without jobs, and some of them being encouraged to go and work in agriculture and sort of in the regions and what have you. But a lot of those people have graduates, they've got degrees, they want to go into a high tech or one of the reasons why, of course, there's a lot of interest in migrating to other places, including Australia, which is part of the migration story. The next part of the puzzle for China is the shadow banking sector. So with the economy going very weak, and with GDP going backwards and with exports falling, there is a real question about the shadow banking sector. And this was one that came up. There's a few others going on. The shadow banks are really now under a significant pressure. And so they've set up a task force to try and actually understand what's going on. But we have a feeling that this is going to be another critical factor to watch in China, because it's not necessarily the officially controlled banking system, which they can sort of pull levers against. It's this deregulated, unregulated shadow banking system, which is huge, not well reported, not well understood. So it's a bit like 2007 in the US, but this time in China.
Yeah, well, we might talk about that as we get into some of the Australian lending by the second tiers as well, because I've got a bit of a theory that I think is starting to play out with everything that's happening that I might get into later on. But China growth estimates are down as well.
Correct. So everybody's now saying, oh, China's not going to do very well at all. And of course, the official 4, 5, 6 numbers being reduced. And the question is, how far will it go? And the point is that the demographic shifts and all those things have started to say, we need to see intervention from the Chinese government, so more stimulus. Now, they've done a few things. So they dropped the target interest rate just a little bit, only 10 basis points the last few days. They've encouraged some of their major players to be selective in the way that they've actually operating in the market, which is sort of market manipulation by another name. And in fact, if you look at the Hong Kong Hang Seng, it was going down, 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 and suddenly it sort of spiked. And when people started looking at it, well, hang on a moment, this seems to be intervention again. So the point is, of course, that these markets are not necessarily that free. And what this means is that it's probably a big question now as to whether China will do the sort of stimulus they did back in 2007, 2008, which is what the markets were banking on. And in fact, recent data is showing that investors are pulling out of China rather than going into China, because they're not convinced necessarily that the government's going to do much. In fact, politically speaking, they might let it ride.
Shanghai Composite's just been chopping around and drifting down a bit the past year or so.
Yeah, exactly. And so you can see the impact on the markets. If you compare that with the US markets, it's gone nowhere for quite a little while. In fact, the numbers are pretty weak at the moment. And if you compare that with the NASDAQ, which we'll look at later, completely different story. But look at also the yuan, right? Because of what's happened here and because of the weakness of the Chinese economy, their exchange rate is moving against them dramatically. The issue there, of course, is they might be actually seeing inflationary pressures coming in through that channel. So this is a really, really quite questionable story here. And will they be happy in China with the yuan moving against the dollar, or will they try and intervene? And if they do, what's the impact? But this is a very significant trend now.
Yeah, we're still always seeing those stories pop up about the BRICS and possibly having these commodity-backed currencies and all that, sort of always lurking in the background as well.
Well, they're meeting, of course, in South Africa at the moment and trying to actually create this other bloc, although it's a bit of a mixture of who's in the bloc, from Russia all the way through. But they are trying to now attract other second-tier economies to come into that block, and China's leading the way. They're trying to effectively create an alternative economic narrative, an according power block structure, a very different one. And whether that's going to work or not, is it going to be backed by gold or not? I mean, all of those questions. There are people on one hand saying, no, the US dollar is going to stay preeminent because it is by far the biggest and most influential currency. And of course, it's backed by one of the biggest economies in the world. There are others are saying, well, maybe this is the beginning of the migration away from the great US dollar. A point I want to make is all of these conversations will have an impact on what happens in Australia and the Australian economy. And if, in fact, China doesn't do a lot of stimulation, as we were touching on, that's going to have a very negative impact on what's happening locally in Australia.
Yeah, because of Australia's close ties to both, it could create more volatility here than a lot of other places with what's going on.
Well, we're already seeing it. We're already seeing it with some of the movements of capital, and also the fact that the commodity prices are not as strong as they were, and people are expecting they will continue to slide because demand from China will be weaker. And all of those things mean we're sort of caught in the middle now. Our major trade partner is China, but our major power of influence is the US, you know, look at AUKUS and everything else. And so we're caught in the middle.
Yes. All right. So next up, as you mentioned before, the US consumer continues to be pretty strong.
Well, it's pretty important because 70% of the economy in the US is consumer-led. So, and it, retail sales were up again. And in fact, if you look at the latest numbers, unemployment's pretty good, wages are growing. And so as a result of that, looking at the next slide, the NASDAQ's been quite strong. It went to a new, you know, recent peak, and then it's come back. And what's happened here, and this is the thing to understand, is that the expectation about rates going to get cut later in the year and the economy going through a bit of a recession. So they started, the market started to push the recession out and out and out. Now people are talking about the immaculate soft landing. So there maybe will be no recession. But markets are beginning to get a bit twitchy because they went up very strongly, particularly, of course, through AI, as we mentioned with Nvidia and five or six other stocks. And so the question is, what is fair value on the US markets? And at the moment, you know, the NASDAQ's come back quite a long way. And so people are saying, well, will it continue to fall? Will it go sideways? Will it go up? Who knows? But there's a really amazing contrast in terms of the NASDAQ relative to the Chinese economy as reflected in the two indices.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact stats, but I think it was those seven top stocks were responsible for, you know, X percent, the majority of the gains that we've seen.
It's pretty much all of the gains. And in fact, there are other stocks doing a lot lower. Nvidia reports later, be very interesting to see. But the real thing to understand that alongside that stronger US is what's happened to bond rates, right? So the yields have gone dramatically higher. So the 2-year, which is the next slide, is, well, it's around 5%. It's come back a little bit now this morning, but it's around 5%, which is massive. I mean, it's very, very high. And the 10-year, which is, you know, you could argue the 2-year is more of a signal of where cash rates are going to be. So the 2-year is saying Fed ain't going to cut anytime soon. And even the 10-year is up at 4.2, give or take, right? So these significant rate rises is one of the reasons why the NASDAQ's come back a bit, because of course a lot of technology stocks are highly leveraged, and that means that their future value is being discounted more heavily because of these higher rates. And so there's a real question now, is are we coming back to a new interest rate environment where in fact rates are going to be higher for longer? And maybe the expectation that the Fed is going to cut is a false expectation. Maybe they won't. Maybe they'll keep rates at this level because inflation is still not yet done. And trying to get back down to 2% when they're, you know, well above that at the moment may be impossible, which means that we may see interest rates continue to rise. And high bond rates, of course, means that future funding for corporates, future mortgage rates in the US will be higher. And by the way, it also has a spillover effect into things like crypto, because, you know, or gold, because effectively, by definition, you get better returns from some of those areas than some of these. So this is a really important trend to watch. And I think it's probably one of the big movements that no real analysts, many analysts, thought about, because they all thought the Fed was going to cut, or maybe the Fed won't cut.
Yeah, we might see some new styles of intervention if we have to keep rates high, and that neutral rate of inflation is a lot higher, and then the benchmark rate's a lot higher, and then we're seeing the, you know, Operation Twist or whatever it was in the past. We're going to see these new forms of intervention to try and stimulate the economy.
Well, the question, it doesn't need stimulating because the GDP now is at 5 or 6%, 3-month annualized, right? So they're saying, well, maybe we don't have a problem with slowing economy, which means we may not need to stimulate. But these higher rates have consequences. Now, you know, Moody's have downgraded more US banks, because particularly some of the regional banks, because of these high rates. Why? Because people are taking money out of the banking system and putting it back into the markets, particularly into bonds and to the money managers. And Fitch downgraded the United States on the next slide overall, because they said, well, actually, we don't think that the US economy is being managed very well. And of course, that was in the timing was amazing, because then the Treasury came out and said, right, we're going to have to issue a huge amounts of bonds in the US to be able to stock up our coffers. So there's a huge flood of new bonds being issued, and that's going to be a big issuance over the medium term. And of course, the markets are saying, well, if you're going to flood the market with this sort of this bond, we're going to actually want a higher return because the risks are higher. So that's one of the reasons why these bond rates are going up, because the risk return question is now back in vogue. But I'm looking at the markets here through the lens of some of these banks, and it's interesting that Moody's now downgraded some of the and S&P's followed. So, you know, we are in the situation where these high interest rates are going to have consequences, and maybe something will break.
Yeah, and I guess that's kind of the theory I wanted to mention, is that I think this is all setting up. If you can clean out all those small and medium-sized banks, all the second-tier mortgage lenders and all that type of thing, then it's a lot easier to issue in this central bank digital currency and just have the big four in Australia, or, you know, the big X in America, whatever these other countries are, as this more totalitarian system of control. They're really looking to roll that out now. And this was sort of conspiracy stuff a few years ago, but it really is playing out now. Any thoughts on that, Martin?
Well, yeah, I mean, we know that there are a number of central bank digital currency pilots around the place, and they're all talking about using them because, of course, for example, the Fed said, we need more tools. The central bank digital currency gives us more tools for monetary policy. So there's a clear signal there. And as you say, it will be quite helpful not to have too many small players hanging on. So we've seen a consolidation in regional banks in the US, considerable consolidation, and we expect to see more of it. A small number of large players with considerable impact on the market actually helps the central bank digital currency role. But there is a question about, well, what does that mean? Does it mean you don't need retail banks at all? Or are they going to have a different role to play? And, you know, our central bank digital currency is going to be issued by the central bank directly. And do they actually come directly into the retail space directly, almost going past some of the retail banks? This is part of the puzzle. But now, watch this space. I'm of the view that central bank digital currencies are part of the plan. And, you know, whether you talk conspiracy theory or whether you talk about, well, the central banks need more tools, I keep coming back to, well, they've done such good work so far over the last 20 years with the tools they've got, and you want to give them more tools?
Yeah. Yeah, well, if you think about the rate that, ATMs and regional bank branches are getting shut down, it's good luck getting Fed Chair Powell. Like, they just don't have the staff to handle, you know, the complaints department and all that kind of thing. If the Fed now have the direct line to our bank accounts that our wages are going into with the central bank digital currency. So, yeah. Such an interesting space.
Well, it is interesting. It's two factors quickly. In the UK, they've just legislated that cash must be made available to everybody who wants it. So they've actually got now legislation to say you cannot go more than 1 mile or 3 miles to get cash. So that means they're trying to actually allow cash to continue in the economy, which is a big move. And of course, we've had the Regional Banking Task Force inquiry into bank closures in regional Australia, and there were some in Western Australia this last week. That's the inquiry that myself and a couple of other people got going, because we were really worried about the removal of banking facilities and the fact that this just killed local economies in the regions. So those inquiries are continuing to run, and every time they run, more bad stories coming about how the banks are handling those communities, which is shameful. And just quickly on inquiries, the other Senate inquiry is the ASIC inquiry, and I don't know whether you saw that, but today ASIC was actually in the spotlight through the Senate inquiry, and there were a lot of people giving evidence about how poorly ASIC was actually behaving. So you've got these two Senate inquiries in Australia running, both of which, through John Adams and through some of the other people that I'm involved with, we're sort of setting a bit of an agenda here in terms of potential reform. But against the backcloth of central bank digital currency, it's ever more important that we've actually got access to cash, and we've got a regional branch footprint, whether it's through the branches that are there or whether it's through some other players like Australia Post or a better Australia Post or something else. We cannot allow these large players to take control of the financial system to the point where they can actually turn it on, turn it off, allow us to do things or not allow us to do things at their whim. And that is the future that I'm concerned about, which is why these inquiries are so critical.
Yeah. No, great work with all that stuff, Martin. Guys, Martin's links to his Twitter and YouTube and all that are always in the description below. And if you've ever got anything you need me to tweet for you, Martin, to help get out to the wider masses or whatever, I should start doing more of that for you as well.
Yeah, well, I'll appreciate it, because the more we get these messages out, the better. I'll be making a show with John over the next couple of days, specifically on the Senate hearings, because they would just... were remarkable, just showing how bad ASIC was in terms of dealing with what it was doing. And this regional banking inquiry continues to run. There are more hearings ahead, so we'll continue to push that as well.
Beautiful. Okay, next up, we've already touched on this, but anything to add, Martin?
Well, just to say, Jackson Hole Friday, right? What will Powell say? Will Powell say we've got to keep interest rates higher for longer? Probably he will. Will he say, we're not going to be dropping rates anytime soon? He might do that. If he does that, expect markets to fall. If, on the other hand, he says, we still think rates will come down according to our dot plot sometime next year. So what he says is going to be watched very, very heavily by the markets. And I'll be doing a bit of reporting on that over the next few days, because this is a critical, it isn't just him, it's other central bankers there as well. So what tends to come out of Jackson tends to set the agenda into the autumn. And I would remind people that September and October are really tricky months for the markets. If you expect falls any time in the year, they're most September, October time. So watch the next two or three months and watch what Fed says. This is a critical Fed speak opportunity.
Alrighty, so we touched on this as well, but Australian wage growth's actually been reasonably good, depending on what sector you look at lately.
Well, it's gone up a bit, but of course, in real terms, it's not gone up at all, right? So we're still seeing that inflation is eroding the real value of wages. And compared with the US, where wages are very strong, or in the UK, where they've been around 6%, increase, in Australia, much lower still. So there's some wages growth, but it's not sufficient to be able to, in real terms, make any difference at all.
Better in the services sector of late, though?
So it's interesting, if you look at the inflation, what's happening there is the inflation's falling in the goods sector, but inflation is still rising in the services sector. Why? Because higher interest rates are precipitating higher wages growth, and that wages growth is showing up in the services sector. And so the thing to understand, that whilst goods inflation might be coming down because of the supply chain fixes and some of the other things, it's now services inflation which is setting the agenda. And in fact, if you look at the other next chart, you can see there that services inflation in most economies in the euro area and the UK are now rising very fast. Not in the US, but if you look carefully, it's come down, now it's going sideways. So there's a risk that we're going to see wages drive services costs higher. And in fact, I have a theory, I've had it for some time, that we're going to see inflation come down a bit, but then start rising again because of this partly.
Yeah, and it's different to any time throughout history. Because of the rapid increase in the rate rises, but coming off a low base. But now we've got this really tight labor market as well. And yep. So even though, as you've mentioned, goods and all the supply chains reopening has been good for that side of things, but now with, so competitive for jobs, and especially I think about places in Australia where I forget the number, what percent of every dollar we spend goes through Coles and Woolies and all the other subsidiaries and things that they own. And then you think about rents going up, and so most of the dollars that we're spending are being put up and going into those people's pockets, and it just becomes this cycle that feeds on itself when everything's so tight.
Absolutely. And, there's an interesting chart that the UK shows, which is value and volume through the supermarket. So it shows you that the value's gone up, but the volume in terms of what people are buying hasn't gone up. In fact, it's dropping. So people are having to spend more just to spend the same, to get the same. And I think that's part of the problem with the inflationary momentum we've got. But this services inflation, where in fact you can't get people to do the jobs, is a really critical thing. And of course, Woodside at the moment, there's a big dispute with the gas producers. They're talking about them going on strike potentially, and they want a significant wage hike. And so we may well see in the services sector where that pressure will flow through. The other pressure, of course, is in the rental sector, and the next slide just shows you the annual rent rise. This is the CoreLogic data, which is well above 10%. In the CPI, it's only sitting at sort of between 6 and 7% over the last year. So there's more to come in the rental sector, and that's a problem. And, supply is pretty short, as we'll see in a second. And then if you add the third leg to the stool, the utilities costs, which is the next slide, is also going up dramatically. So gas and other household fuels up 26% over the last 12 months, and electricity up 15.5%. And if the Woodside things puts more pressure on the upside to gas prices, that could actually make utility prices even higher. And interestingly, that over the last few days, gas prices around the world have gone up dramatically because of what's happened with Woodside. Although the last 24 hours, it's come back a little bit because there's talk about maybe Woodside finding a way forward, but we'll see. My point is, these inflationary pressures are still in the system. They're not done yet. And so it may well be hard for central banks to get back to 2%, which then begs the question. So will they stay in tight interest rates, high interest rates, until we get back to 2%? Or will they say, oh, it's too hard to get down, so we won't go down as far as that? And there's some debate in the US as to whether, in fact, the Fed will sort of go to a soft 2.5 rather than a hard 2%.
Yeah, we've probably both spoken about shrinkflation on our channels in the past, where there's one less Tim Tam in the packet every year. Or interesting to think about it, though, in terms of, you know, like the units and houses and what you're getting for your dollar getting smaller and smaller every year. And is it heading down that path where central banks can say, you know, inflation's not actually going up anymore, the costs of things, but we're just seeing that, I guess, become more extreme in terms of you're actually getting less and less goods or services for your dollar rather than the price going up.
Well, effectively, you could argue that the value of a dollar is going down, right? And that's why house prices are going up and why food prices are going up. You get less for each dollar that you've got. And that's probably a better way to think about it. So it's a hidden tax, really, on what people are spending.
Sounds like we might need a currency that's finite, like Bitcoin, man.
Something which can't be inflated away might be quite useful. Mm. Yeah,
might come into itself eventually. But, so wage price index.
Yeah, just to say that the latest data showed that in Australia, the wage price index has just tipped over. So it was high, but then it tipped back. Not so in many other countries where it's still a lot stronger. So there's a big interesting question now as to whether we are going to see more wage price hikes in Australia, or whether in fact it will stay contained. And in fact, recently the Reserve Bank said that may well be contained, but they then went on to say, but we still think unemployment needs to rise. So one to watch.
And real wages trimmed here?
Yeah, so this is basically adjusting real wages by the deflator, whether you use the trimmed mean CPI, whether you use the season just CPI. In real terms, you know, there's been no growth between 2010 and now on average terms, right? If you look at the seasonally adjusted CPI, if you look at the trimmed mean, it's up a little bit, but up hardly at all. I mean, this is the context for all the pressures on households, right? In real terms, people are not earning more than they were before. It goes right back to what I said, that value of your dollar's gone down, so your ability to spend is not actually improving. And that's the real story. It's the one that we should be talking about much more than we are at the moment, because this is the hidden tax on everybody, actually all around the world.
Indeed. So cash rate forecasts.
So it's interesting, the markets are now saying, well, maybe we'll see the cash rate at 4%. You know, through 2024, CBA is still holding for a 3% in 2024. So they're actually forecasting rates to drop next year. And that's the real dilemma. So if the global interest rate environment is continuing higher, as I showed you with those bond rates, it's going to be harder and harder to actually drop the Aussie rate. Because if you do, the exchange rate's going to get murdered even more. And we'll talk about the exchange rate towards the end of the show here, because I think it's one to watch. The fact is, we're not necessarily going to see rates come back down to anything like we were used to a couple of years ago. So, you know, 0.1% cash and a 2% mortgage rate, we're probably never going to see that again, because things have changed and the interest rate environment has now moved up to a much higher level. And that's the problem. So CBA has always tended to be on the downside of forecasting. Others are forecasting higher rates. The market is 4% through next year.
Retail trade volumes?
Just to say, it's going through the floor. So now retail is really under the gun here. And you can see here that over the quarter, things are really getting quite difficult. And again, what you find is some households still have plenty of money and are spending quite freely. But others now, particularly those with a mortgage or those with rent burdens, are actually spending a lot less. And they're focusing more on the things they must buy, which is things like food, rather than actually the discretionary things, which were a very large part of the economy over the last couple of years. So this is a very important indicator about the weakness of the Australian economy.
And a lot of people have drawn down on a lot of those savings as well recently. Yeah.
Well, we'll look at the savings ratio in a second, but just before we do that, let's talk about the fixed loan expiry. It's not yet done. This is the latest from CBA. We're about halfway through, just over halfway through. So there's more fixed rates still flipping to much higher rates. And this pressure, you know, turning the vice ever tighter on mortgage holders is not complete yet. There's a long way to go, another year or so before we're really through this. That's a really important observation. And you can see just how high interest rates are now relative to where they were.
And we've seen that in a lot of the most recent commentary around the percentage of investors that are now selling and selling at a loss and listings coming on. We mentioned, I think it was last month, about how it was unseasonal for so many listings to be coming on. So we're really seeing that now, particularly in Melbourne and Sydney, Alan.
Yeah, we'll see a slide on that just in a couple of slides because it's very important to understand that. Because if you then say, well, we've got pressure on households, there's not real any wages growth, we've got inflationary pressure still in the system, we've got these rate rises, the other factor is saving. So the saving ratio continues to fall. It's below the long-term trends now. And that means that people are raiding their savings where they can. And the next slide is my mortgage stress data, which again hit another high. So unfortunately, more people are now, from a cash flow perspective, getting caught, particularly those in the rental sector. So 68% of households in the rental sector have cash flow issues. And we're now up at 49.9%, almost half of households with a mortgage have a cash flow problem to deal with as well. So these are intractable long-term pressures that are actually going to really put pressure directly on households, which this might be one of the reasons why the RBA won't put rates up higher, although the markets are a bit uncertain about that. And then if you come to the property story, just briefly to sort of round this out, well, the annual change in rents is still very strong, although it's tipped down a little bit in Sydney. Dwelling prices were up again for some areas over the last month, although it's not uniform. You know, if you look at some of them, there was a bit of a rise. Melbourne's only up 0.3% in the last month, Sydney up 0.9%, whereas Adelaide and Brisbane was 1.4% over the last month. But it does vary now out in the regions. It's a different story. So we're starting to see potentially home prices beginning to go the other way. And then if you look at the next slide, that's really about two things. One is the vacancy rental rates are still pretty low, particularly in the combined capitals. So that's going to put more upward pressure on rents. But the listings, the new listings, continues to actually perform a little bit above the long-term trends. It's still low relative, but also different from what we see normally. And as we said just now, and just to reiterate, some of those property investors have started to sell. All the agents I speak with are saying expect more listings to come on the next couple of months. And if you put that into the mix with everything else, it's very hard to think of how we are going to see home prices continuing their rise despite the high migration. So interesting one to watch, but I have a feeling we are going to see the markets turning again as we come into the spring.
Yeah, and final slide, the Aussie dollar has been particularly weak lately.
This is a very big concern, right? Because we're now down at 64 cents to the US. And that means, of course, we risk importing inflation. It also means that if the RBA doesn't lift rates, we're going to see the exchange rate continue to get weaker. And there's a real risk with a very weak exchange rate, not least because, of course, our banking system is reliant on international financing as well as deposit rates. And what that means is that we could actually also see a bunch of other things fall off the log because of where the exchange rate is. It's also weak with against the pound as well. So the weaker Australian economy and the weak story of growth and the weak story of wage and everything else that we've touched on is in sharp contrast to these macro trends that we're actually seeing between China and the US and the high rates, particularly in the US and the bond rates. As a result of that, my expectation is the Australian economy is in for a really bumpy ride over the next few months. And so I would expect the exchange rate to stay weak. And that might mean that the RBA will have to actually sort of be caught between putting rates up to try and deal with inflation, which is still coming in, on the other hand, trying not to kill the exchange rate too far. So I think the RBA has got a real big question now as to what it's going to do, particularly when it meets next.
Yeah, and just to reiterate all that for people at home, if you can get 5.5% in the US as the World Reserve's currency versus 4.5% in Australia, that's why we're going to see more money go there. It's just that safer option. And because we're lower compared to everything else, that currency keeps declining. But then, as Martin said, you risk importing as the cost of goods continue to climb relative to our currency, importing more inflation and perpetuating that cycle where our wages keep going up. We just can't, if the RBA haven't gone as hard as New Zealand and other places, and we can never quite get in front of that inflation while that natural inflation rate that they're saying is the new normal continues to creep higher as well.
That's right. And just to sort of round that out, Japan is also another interesting case study because they kept rates really low, but they've started to allow rates to move up a bit. And so some of that investor funds that flowed out of Japan into the US is coming back home. So there are huge international movements of capital around the place, supported by these very high interest rates that we're now seeing. And you know, the net of all this is weaker trade for Australia, weaker financial position for Australia, and frankly, weaker position for households in Australia. So, you know, wherever you look, the news locally is pretty weak. So I think the next two or three months will be really interesting. And I think next time when we, you know, chat again, we'll be able to see some of these developments evolving. But I'm quite concerned about the weakness of the Australian economy at the moment.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Martin. And thanks to everyone that commented. There's some great comments. I'm not sure if you saw on last month's video. So we love to hear anything that's happening on the front lines or things you're seeing and feeling. But thanks for joining us, Martin. Looking forward to next month's conversation already.
Great. Cheers. See you then. Cheers.
Cheers, guys.